Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker and also our moderator. Our speaker today is Steve Hildebrand, former deputy director of Obama's 08 campaign. He continues to advise the president working to restore marriage equality in California, and is a new member of Bevin Duffy's mayoral campaign. Sandeep Roy, who hosts the radio show New America Now on KALW 91.7 FM and also provides commentary on NPR's Morning Edition, will moderate. At this point, I'd like to turn the program over to Sandeep.
Thank you, Lori. My name is Sandeep Roy. I'm an editor with New America Media. It's my pleasure to moderate tonight's program. A couple of months ago, when President Barack Obama met with LGBT constituents, he singled out our guest as the person who, as he said, was partly responsible for putting Barack Obama in the White House. And this person was, of course, our guest, Steve Hildebrand, as the deputy director of the campaign. He's had a long history with campaigns before the Obama campaign, including senatorial campaigns. He's been chair of the Democratic Committee in the state. And right now, when the LGBT, though he's not officially involved with the administration anymore, when the LGBT community got a little restless, it was Steve Hildebrand who went to the White House to meet the president to tell him what was going on out there. And now he's been involved with the marriage issue in California as an advisor, or involved with the Courage campaign. And now we hear you're going to be coming even closer to California, to San Francisco, in fact, by being an advisor with Bevin Duffy's mayoral campaign. And if Politico is to be believed, then recently even Steve Hildebrand, who has defended the president on many occasions from critics on the left who say he's not moving fast enough, is losing patience with the administration. Is he or isn't he? Well, we have the man himself here, so please help me welcome Steve Hildebrand.
Thanks, Andy. This is much too serious of a podium for me. It's great to be here. I have really grown fond of your city over the last many months, working with Bevin's campaign, getting that off the ground, and on the marriage equality issue. And my partner and I also vacationed here during the Obama campaign when I needed to get the hell away, and had a great time here. He made me walk everywhere, everywhere. And we're from South Dakota, so we don't really walk anywhere. We drive everywhere. I guess I want to start by just kind of giving you a very brief background of how I joined Barack Obama in that great adventure. In the spring and summer of 2006, like many Americans, I was growing very weary and very sad with the many deaths that were occurring with Americans fighting the Iraq War. And I was growing, impatient might be the word of the night. I tend to be impatient. I'm the youngest of nine kids, you know. I never got anything. I was growing impatient with many in Washington, but I was growing impatient particularly with the Clintons. And I am a past Clinton Gore advocate, campaign worker, fundraiser. I was very, very involved in 92 and 96, and again in 2000 with Al Gore. So that was that's kind of where my allegiances were. And I was very much gearing up, should she have wanted me, to work with Senator Clinton's campaign for the presidency. I believed a lot in her and her husband and what they can do and have done for this country. But I was growing impatient with the fact that neither of the Clintons were speaking up in a forceful way against the war in Iraq and bringing it to an end. And as my associates and I would sit in our office working for clients, we would have the TV on CNN or MSNBC, and there was just, you know, death after death after death, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And I made the decision at that time that I was either going to find another candidate or I was going to sit out the presidential campaign in 2008. I was called about a month later by Pete Rouse, who at the time was Senator Obama's chief of staff. He had been Tom Daschle's chief of staff in the Senate, who I had worked for, and Pete's a long, great friend. And he said that the senator had been invited by Senator Harkin to go to Iowa to attend his annual fundraiser, his big fall steak fry, and be the keynote speaker. And I had worked, I ran the caucuses, the Iowa caucuses for Al Gore in 2000. And Pete asked if I would accompany Barack to the event, knowing full well that this event tends to be a showcase, a showplace, I should say, for presidential wannabes. At the time, Senator Obama had no intention of trying to ratchet up any attention about running for the presidency because he really, at that point, was probably not going to run. I had never met him before. I didn't have a chance to hear his speech at the convention in 2004 because I was running another campaign. And I really heard from so many friends around the country how incredible this guy was. And I thought, well, I need somebody incredible right now because I'm losing a lot of desire to be involved in politics because I think Washington has really failed us in so many ways. So I drove the 4 hours from Sioux Falls, my hometown, to Des Moines to meet this guy on a Sunday morning. I went with Senator Harkin and his wife Ruth to pick up Senator Obama at the airport, and you know, here comes this African-American guy into the Des Moines airport, coming down the escalator all by himself with one little briefcase. He wasn't staying overnight. And I wasn't so excited to meet him as I was excited to hear him. And many people who know me as somebody who shouldn't necessarily be the staff person to move a candidate around on a schedule, because I tend to be a little bit aloof and not necessarily great on detail. So here comes Senator Obama, and I'm supposed to step up to the plate and know how to manage him through what was going to be a very large crowd that day at the steak fry. So we went to a couple of events, early, you know, larger donor fundraisers, and then we went out to the fairgrounds to meet the big crowd. And there were about 3,500 people there. And when we got out of the van, I couldn't believe what was ahead. There were 16 TV cameras from, you know, CNN and MSNBC and Fox and affiliates in St. Louis and Omaha and all over the place coming to cover this guy. And lots of still photographers, lots of reporters, tons of national press. For a guy who was pretty clear at that time that he wasn't going to run for the presidency. So we go, we get out of the van, and the intensity was felt immediately. The cameras were just unbelievable in how aggressive they were to try and get a shot of this guy. The reporters just, you know, were crowding him, and the crowd itself just kind of started to move towards him. The event is a four-hour event, and the speaking program is probably about an hour of it, and the rest of it is mixing and mingling. And I don't think there was a person there who didn't have a chance to meet him. And what I saw that day, again, I was really interested in hearing his speech. His speech became very secondary. What I saw was people of all ages, all backgrounds, different ethnicities. So mesmerized by this guy and so hungry to meet him. And at that time, it was before his second book had been released. So his previous book was released 13 years earlier. There had to have been 400 or 500 people who brought that first book, printed 13 years earlier, with hopes that they could just get a signature from him. And I really wanted to watch, at that point, how he interacted with the crowd. You know, if you're going to run for president and you go through the Iowa caucuses or the New Hampshire primary, it's really about retail politics. And I wanted to see if this guy could connect. I wanted to see if this guy was really interested in meeting people. And to cut this part short, on my four-hour drive home that night, a little piece of background. The senator was supposed to fly home on a fly back to Chicago on a commercial flight that night, and I think there was weather in Chicago or something, so he couldn't, the flight got canceled. He couldn't get a private plane either, of course. But one of his staff people from the Chicago office had rented a car and driven down, and the only car that was available for him to rent was a PT Cruiser. And so Senator Obama, now the President of the United States, drove back to Chicago from Des Moines, Iowa, in a PT Cruiser on his first solo event, heading out to start a presidential campaign, because that's really what it started. On my drive home that night for 4 hours, I burned up every minute I could get on my cell phone, calling everybody I could think of who would actually care about this guy, about the presidency, and about what I felt that day. He connected like no politician I've ever been with. The interaction that people had, the emotions that people had for this guy, you know, at the end of the day, I said to him, is it like this in other places? I said, how do people know so much about you? How are people so emotionally connected to you? And he said, it's like this everywhere I go. And he said, I don't know how to process it. But I saw, you know, little old ladies embracing him, saying, you know, thank you for being who you are. I saw 19-year-old men shaking when they got near him. It was all such a fascinating day. So I immediately started making the Kool-Aid and passing it out, gallons at a time. I got up early the next morning and went to my office about 6 a.m. I went through all the news clips to see what was there, and I pulled them all together in one email stream and decided to send them out to everybody I could think of on my email list. A lot of national reporters, a lot of Clinton loyalists, a lot of people like myself who were feeling sort of hopeless for the future. And I got up Tuesday morning and did the same thing, and I got up every morning for the next 3 months and spammed everybody I could think of with news about Barack Obama. And the list grew and grew and grew of people who said, you know, this was forwarded on to me, please add me to your list. And we started strategy meetings at that point to determine whether or not this made any sense for him to run. A small group of us, about eight of us, along with Barack and Michelle and their two best friends who were there to keep the political consultants honest. And we met on several occasions. The Obamas, to their credit, demanded that this be a very, very serious process, that this wasn't just going to be a, you know, sit around and try and decide if America loves you enough to become president. This was, I want to know what a daily schedule looks like. I want to know if I'm ever going to see my kids. I want to know what this campaign's going to cost. I want to find out how we're going to raise the money. I mean, he made us go through a very rigorous process, to his credit. And Michelle, the same way. Very serious people, very grounded people. And in many respects, the rest is history. It was an honor of a lifetime to be involved with him, to be involved with now First Lady Michelle Obama, who is a remarkable, remarkable person in herself, in her own right. And, you know, from a kid who grew up poor in South Dakota to go on that kind of a ride when you're such a political animal to start with was pretty phenomenal. Just a couple things about the campaign. There were a couple of things. You know, these presidential campaigns are really not that fun to work on. You're leaving your family. You're taking a pay cut, usually. You're working very long hours. You're under a microscope, a lot of stress, and it's a serious game. And there were often times where I wondered if I had the energy at the age of 46 to do this two-year marathon. It was a very, very stressful thing, and by no means for me, but for the 6,000 employees of the campaign, if that's the number that we actually had. There were a couple of things that really kept me going. One was the 23-year-olds on staff. 22, 23, 24, 25, the youngest, smartest, brightest people I've ever worked with, the millennial generation. I learned so much from these people, and I was so inspired every single day. They worked their tail off. They were so smart. They were so strategic. They were so committed, and they were passing out the Kool-Aid just as much as I was, if not more. The other piece that... And you know, I should throw in a very serious way, in a very sincere way, that it was also the people in the grassroots, the people who were given $10 and $25, the people who were giving $100 contributions like they've never actually given to a political campaign before, the millions of people that were so inspired to actually get off their couch and go work for this guy. That was so inspirational. But the other thing that really kept me going was the possibility that one day he was going to stand on the steps of the Capitol and raise his right hand and be sworn in as president. And I knew at that moment, if we could get there, how life-changing it would be for millions and millions and millions of people around this world. People who have looked at America as a white leadership, people who have, you know, gone through 8 years of a Bush presidency and looked at America differently than they had looked at America before, losing some pride that they've always shown. But for young people, for poor people, for people of color, for anybody who needed that moment, that's something that I always kept in my mind. I just wanted to get there. I wanted, for all the good things a president can do, this one didn't take legislative action. This one didn't take the signing of a pen. It took the raising of a right hand to impact so many Americans and so many people from around this world. And to show up that day and see that crowd in Washington was just unbelievable. I don't remember a word of his speech, but I remember being so inspired by that crowd and by what that moment was going to do for so many people who needed that moment. His presidency. We're 8 months into it. I was given this analogy. I won't take credit for this. But I was given this analogy by a friend of mine who said, you know, this is a guy who basically showed up on day one and had the Titanic handed to him. The hardest day probably of any president in history to figure out how to begin to put this country back on track. So there was economic news today in which the president stated that They believe we are now no longer going downwards in the economy, but we're actually heading back up. And if you think about what he was handed, an economic situation that's unparalleled virtually in this country, a deficit and debt that's breathtaking, a polarized electorate and a Washington that is so broken, a healthcare system that desperately needs an overhaul, climate change changing every single day. And if we don't do something soon, there will be too much harm to ever be able to go back. You know the list. I mean, it's a huge, huge list. And I believe, and you know where I come from. I'm a Obama loyalist. But I think he's made a substantial impact at this point. Substantial. I think that history is going to have to take a harder look at this first year and probably this four-year period, because it's hard to be immersed in it and sort of understand the magnitude of what he has to do and what Congress has to do and what we Americans have to do to get this country back on track. You know, multiple wars, there's just too much. So I have my problems with Washington. My problems are more centered on Congress than anywhere else. I have a real problem with Democrats having significant majorities like we haven't seen before in the House and Senate, and a Democratic president, and we still can't get substantial things done that our party cares about and that a lot of Americans care about. Healthcare reform should be a slam dunk. Equality for gay Americans should be a slam dunk. Climate change legislation should be a slam dunk. There's so many things that we say as a party we believe in that shouldn't take so many months and potentially so many years to get done. I have particular problems with these blue dog Democrats, as they call themselves, in the House, and the conservative Democrats in the Senate. They are holding up progress, and they need pressure. They need to feel it. They need to feel it. They should either act as Democrats or they should change parties. They are more concerned about their reelection than they are about doing the right thing. And until they turn that around and prove to us that that's not the case, I really have lost my patience with them. I spent 22 years of my life working full-time for these candidates, for these Democrats. I've given up a lot. I missed a sister's wedding because I thought the campaign was too important. I missed a lot of family events because I thought the campaign was too important. I took, you know, leaves away from my family and pay cuts because I thought the campaign was so important. But in 22 years, where's the progress? Where's my satisfaction in these people? It's broken. And in 8 months, with Democrats firmly in the majority, we don't see, at least I don't see, much of a turnaround. Washington's still broke, even though we have 60 votes in the Senate, huge majority in the House. Why aren't we getting things done? Why don't we have health care reform? Why don't we have climate change legislation? There are so many things. These blue dogs are standing in the way. I don't even know what a blue dog is, to be honest with you. I sort of think of it as someone who's afraid of their next election and much more concerned about that than they are about solving the problems that our country faces. I've tried to say constructively, which is difficult when I talk about these folks, that if they're so concerned about their next election, they should reform health care, because voters in their districts want it just as badly as voters in any other district, whether it's Nancy Pelosi's liberal district here in San Francisco or in a conservative district in the middle of Missouri. Health care reform is what the American people want. They want a public option in that reform, and this Congress should be forced to do it, and they need pressure, and you all should put pressure on them. I want to talk a little bit about issues important to LGBT Americans and many who love us. I have not spent my adulthood doing a lot of advocacy work for gay issues. I have really been focused on candidate stuff. But I made the decision earlier this year that while I want to help selective candidates for office, I really think that I can make a bigger difference, and many of us can make a bigger difference if we focus on taking issues directly to the voters. So in South Dakota, we're working hard. We just are in the process of launching a campaign to repeal our state's ban on stem cell research. We have a $400 million donor who contributed to one of our healthcare systems there, and a big piece of what he wants to do is research, and specifically research to cure juvenile diabetes, of which the greatest hope is with embryonic stem cell research, and our state has a law banning it. So we're going to take that to the people. And if you think about that, from my standpoint, should I help another candidate go to Washington and be part of a broken system and get into the same old traps of fundraisers every night and call time during the day, begging for money? Or should we, in big ways and small, figure out how to affect people's lives in a better way? And it's really where I want to move my life. If I can have any potential effect in helping somebody live a better life, that's more important to me than helping another politician get elected to office. It's why when folks reached out to me here in California about the marriage initiative, I was pretty quick to respond to say, well, I think the gay community in California is just as disorganized as any other community in the country, whether it's labor or the Republican Party or whatever. The cause is so critical. Marriage rights for all Americans is just a fundamental, in my opinion, easy step. What's so wrong? What's so wrong about it? Straight people don't own marriage. Churches don't own marriage. The Constitution in our country and in our states decides. And if our government and the people who support the government want discrimination, then they should keep it. I don't think we should have discrimination at any level in our society. It is almost 2010. Have we really advanced as far as we should? Not just on marriage equality, but a whole host of issues that are affecting the lives of gay Americans. Think about this. This is it's a bit disturbing, in my opinion. In the 40 years since Stonewall, the Congress of the United States has done almost nothing to further equality for LGBT Americans. Almost nothing. In the last few months, they passed hate crimes legislation, which is still being thrown around in committees, conference committees, to come up with the final legislation. So we don't even know for sure if it's going to happen. Hate crimes is such a no-brainer. How can you say you represent the people of a district or a state and say that bullying should be tolerated, that young people who are committing suicide because they're either picked on because they're gay or they're picked on because they're perceived to be gay? It's happening. So how do you justify that as a political leader in this country? How do you justify opposing that? So think about this. 40 years, no progress. 40 years, four decades, no progress. Should we be impatient? Hell yeah. There have been so many incredible leaders trying to advance the rights of LGBT people. Harvey Milk, I mean, so many of them. So many of them have had such an impact on plenty of people's lives, probably in this room. But Congress, they get no credit. They get a lot of blame, and they deserve it. If you think about the 40 years with no forward progress, think about the steps we've taken back. What Congress has actually taken away from gay Americans. Not moved things ahead, but actually taken back. In the mid-90s, don't ask, don't tell, a ridiculous military policy that has forced 13,000, more than 13,000 gay military service people out of the military. You have a couple of incredible people here in your state. Lieutenant Dan Choi, West Point grad, led his platoon into battle, long service in Iraq, over in Oakland. Anthony Woods, West Point grad. You know, these aren't degenerates. These aren't bad people. These are people that voluntarily signed up to serve our country in a time of war. Think of the courage that it takes for any person to sign up for military service in a time of war, to be thrust over into Iraq in such dangerous and uncertain times, dangerous and uncertain territory, to be taken away from your family with no sense of when you're coming back. Then think of the courage it takes for gay people to put themselves in that same situation. Our government, our Congress, and a previous president put this into law and said, just because of who you are, you can't serve in our military. Well, how shameful is that? How discriminatory is that? This should be a no-brainer for Congress to repeal. It should be simple. Employment non-discrimination. Well, let me go back. The other step backward in a significant way was the Defense of Marriage Act. Let's not give them rights. Let's actually make it harder for them to ever achieve marriage rights. Congress passes it. The president signs it. They take away rights. They don't make forward progress. 40 years. Impatient? Hell yes. Why should we wait one more day? We shouldn't have to. We should not have to. We pay taxes. We have the right to vote. We are asked to be good citizens. We work hard. We are no different. And if a straight person believes they are better than I am, they're wrong. I'm not better than them. But they have more rights than I do. They have more rights than gay Americans all across this country. It's 2010. It's been 40 years since the Stonewall riots, and we have not made progress. We have taken steps backwards. We are not going to be patient anymore. Employment non-discrimination. Listen to this. There's not a Republican member of Congress from the state of California who is supporting legislation to eliminate discrimination in the workplace. Almost every Democrat is supporting it and has signed on to the bill in California. There's one Republican who's sitting out there trying to decide where the wind's going to blow, Mary Bono. If she doesn't think she has enough gay people in her district in Palm Springs, she's up for re-election. She'll have one of the toughest re-elections in history. If she wants to be re-elected, she should probably get on board, support employment non-discrimination. I was in New York and on Long Island giving a speech a few months ago, and I was asked to meet with some of the workers. And there were gay workers at this particular facility. And I wasn't really sure why they wanted to meet in advance of the speech. But when I sat down with them, they poured their hearts out to me about the amount of discrimination that they feel in the workplace. And it honestly took me aback. I couldn't believe how much and what they go through. How hard is it to say nobody should be discriminated in the workplace? How hard is that? There's issue after issue after issue that Congress could pass easily if they had the courage to do so, if they cared enough to do so. Why should we be patient? Why should we say that the Congress of the United States should continue to allow discrimination in this country? Why should they say, sign up to serve in the military, but don't tell us you're gay? Why should they deny visitation rights for a partner who's in the hospital? I don't get it. I don't get it. There are so many African Americans who wondered if they ever would see an African American president. As a gay person, I'm wondering how much equality I will see in my lifetime. What I honestly and truly believe is that under Barack Obama's leadership, we will have greater advances and we will make up significant progress that we didn't make in 40 years in his 4 years of his presidency. I truly believe that. I know what's in this guy's heart. I know that he wants to make a difference for us. I know that he's going to get the job done in so many ways. At the end of 4 years, will everything be perfect? Of course not. Even with laws, there's still discrimination. African Americans, Native Americans, Chinese Americans, Hispanics, you know, women, gay people, older people, younger people, there is discrimination, people. So no law is going to make this perfect. But what it will do is say to every gay person in America, our government believes that you should be treated equal. That's all I want. I can't change how somebody feels and looks at me, but I can demand that my government recognizes me as an equal. That shouldn't be hard. I live in South Dakota. I'm openly gay. I am proud as hell. I believe that everybody should be as proud as I am, should feel okay about who they are, and fundamentally understand that the government supports them. The government believes in them. The government believes they are people too. We got a big fight on our hands. We can make big progress in the next 4 years if we do this right. And I think more importantly than anything else is if you care about this, be vocal, be active, help us. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Steve Hildebrand, former deputy director of Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. I'm Sandeep Roy, host of New America Now, the program produced by New America Media on KLW 91.7 FM, and I will be moderating today's question-answer period, and we have a large number of questions. So let's begin. Steve, what do you think should be the number one strategic priority of the LGBT rights movement in order to expedite the passing of federal LGBT civil rights legislation? And do you see actions such as the upcoming Equality March as helpful or a poor use of resources?
Well, related to the march, there's not huge resources being spent on it. I believe that it's very important. I think from a strategic standpoint, there's no one answer. We have to do it all. We have to march. We have to lobby. We have to work actively against candidates who don't support us. We have to fund candidates that do. We have to put pressure where pressure needs to be applied. So I don't think there's one answer. And the gay community, like any community, each of us have different priorities. Some people care about marriage first and foremost. Some people care about employment non-discrimination. I think we need to fight every single battle we can get our hands on and not stop until we've done all the work.
How do you think, though, that gay political power can be taken more seriously in Washington, D.C., instead of always being told, in a sense, to take one for the larger cause? I mean, who does the president listen to on gay issues? I mean, he did not give a sit-down interview with any LGBT magazines other than I think there was a 15-minute interview with Advocate by phone.
Well, he has said this publicly and privately that he needs pressure too. And I think that's really important. I think gay LGBT leaders, LGBT organizations need to work more closely together. They need to stop worrying about turf battles. They need to be leaders. They need to understand that it's not about their organization. It's about whether or not we can solve these difficult problems and achieve the equality that we so desperately want. And I really do think there's too many LGBT organizations in Washington, just like there's too many other organizations in Washington who are too entrenched in Washington. And they need to take a step back and assess, you know, we're raising millions of dollars every year. What are we really doing to change public policy? And I think, you know, anybody should feel free to put pressure on these organizations as well to make sure that they're doing the hard work. You know, you just think about we're just a few votes away in both the House and the Senate to pass employment non-discrimination. Just a few votes. So what's happening in Palm Springs, one of the most active gay communities in the country, to put pressure on Mary Bono to sign on? I don't think very much. Well, what does that say about gay activism in this country? It's unorganized. There's too many misplaced priorities. And we lose too many opportunities that we should be seizing. You know, I have been publicly critical of my member of Congress, a Democrat, who I've known for years and known her family for years, but she's a Blue Dog Democrat. And she doesn't get my support anymore because she doesn't support me. And more people need to be vocal, more people need to put pressure, more people need to put their pocketbook in place to get some of this stuff done.
Well, since you brought up the issue of your member of Congress who's a Blue Dog Democrat, Blue Dog Democrats will say that they're trying to represent their constituents. As somebody from South Dakota, do you believe this or not?
She's not representing me. I pay taxes in the state. She voted against climate change. She is one of the people who's leading, negotiating for the Blue Dogs on health care, which can only lead to a bad policy. She believes that there should be a constitutional amendment in the United States to outlaw marriage, a constitutional amendment. She doesn't just not support the repeal of DOMA. She actually thinks it should be written into the Constitution. She also favors abortion rights. So it's okay to, you know, do one thing but not the other. She's not consistent, and she is not reflecting a vast majority of South Dakotans want health care reform with a public option, and she's not working for it. So she and so many other Blue Dogs are not even reading their districts right.
Well, you've brought up the issue of your impatience with Congress and with Blue Dog Democrats, but what about your impatience with the president himself? I mean, the question comes, could not the president be sending down more LGBT-friendly legislations like repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell or things to Congress?
Well, as I said, I think, you know, he said he needs pressure, and I think we should put pressure on him. I want this guy to succeed in so many ways. And it's not just about issues important to the LGBT community, but it's healthcare reform and it's climate change and issues that affect our country and our world. I believe in his heart that by the end of the four-year term, that we will see tremendous progress. I really believe that. I believe we will see a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I believe we will see employment non-discrimination passed. I believe we will see hate crimes passed. I believe that there will be several states in this country that have passed marriage equality. I don't believe that Congress will ever have the courage to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. But there are – look, he has not been silent about issues for our community. He has – gone into the lion's den on a number of occasions during the campaign and spoken directly about equality in this country. And, you know, nobody's perfect. He has his faults like others, but I believe this guy will make a tremendous difference for us. And I will, like I hope all of you, will continue to apply pressure at every opportunity.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Doing the Impossible with Steve Hildebrand, former
deputy. Is that what it's called?
It's called Doing the Impossible. We're dreaming the impossible dream or something. Former deputy director.
It's not impossible.
Of Obama's 2008 campaign, and he's been an advisor to President Obama on LGBT issues, and it's consultant to the Courage campaign and Bevin Dufty's mayoral campaign. You know, you talked about applying pressure, that is something we have to do. And so here is this question. If we can't count on politicians, how do you activate the public? Americans are the most activated consumers. Could we leverage capitalism?
We sure as hell should. In the short period of time that I've been working in California, I've been unbelievably impressed and inspired by the amount of grassroots activity that is taking place in support of marriage equality. And it's not just gay people who are showing up to do the canvases on Saturday. It's a whole lot of straight people. And I think that one of the most impactful things of the Obama campaign was the activism that took place, the unprecedented activism, the large number of voters, the large number of contributors, the amount of sweat and equity that people who had never been involved in a political campaign, gave up so much time, 20, 30, 40 hours a week, every week, for months, and gave up a lot. But they learned how to be organizers. They learned how to be effective at activism. And what we're seeing in California is a lot of those Obama activists who are now spending an incredible amount of their energy on marriage equality and other issues important to the progressive community. And I think it's like, how do you get people active? I think it's like anything. You have to be inspired. You know, people have priorities and people are busy. And in a tough economy, it makes it even harder for some folks. So I think that, you know, activism is based on whether or not there's leadership and whether or not there's inspiration. And finally, whether or not there's a real goal. People need to understand why they're doing this. And if those components are there, I think that you can build activism for anything.
Well, since you brought up marriage equality, we have several questions about that. So let me get to that, about the marriage initiative. We all want the same thing, but there are differences in our community about strategy. Why do you think it's better to go for 2010 rather than 2012?
What I've said about 2010, first of all, I think it's important that I always state I'm not a California resident. I'm not here to tell Californians what to do. Folks here in this state need to make that decision. I was asked by Rick Jacobs of the Courage Campaign and Mark Solomon from Equality California several months ago to come to California and talk about this issue, to talk about potential strategies, to look at 2010, to look at 2012. And as I had discussions with them as well as others, I started doing some work for the Courage Campaign because what I saw is a serious recognition of some of the important steps that need to be in place for whatever year this goes back to the ballot. I have said about 2010 that if these things are in place, we shouldn't wait. You shouldn't wait. That equality shouldn't be on somebody else's time clock. I believe that if the following things are in place, 2010 makes sense. If they're not, we should work towards them for 2012. I think that first and foremost, significant research needs to be done, and I will give the Courage Campaign a lot of credit for taking up this very costly $250,000 research project to give us a sense of how we convince enough people to pass marriage equality, to get a sense of different kinds of people's attitudes towards homosexuality and marriage in particular. And if we don't do that research, we don't really have the basis for a strategy. We don't have the basis to communicate with enough voters to pass this. So I thought the research was vitally important, and the Courage Campaign is about halfway done with that research. Pollsters David Binder and Amy Simon here in San Francisco are leading that effort, and they're doing incredible work, and it's really impressive what we're learning. So that was a simple fundamental, in my opinion, a costly one, but an important one. Number two is that there's a governing structure for a campaign that is respected by the gay community, respected by potential big donors and small. If there's not $25 million or more dollars that are out there to be raised, a battle shouldn't be waged. We shouldn't fight to lose a campaign. We should figure out how to put together a winning campaign. And I think that a strong governing structure that's well-respected throughout the gay community and the progressive community and the donor community is critical. If people have respect And if people have confidence in who the leadership is of the campaign, people will be more inclined to be participants in that campaign, whether it's through activism, through contributions, or whatever. Number three is that they have a professional staff with statewide experience in California, and it would be helpful if they had that experience on ballot initiatives because they're different than candidate campaigns. So I think there's a whole bunch of things that have to be in place before a campaign should be waged. All of those could be in place for 2010, although time is running out to get them in place, and there's a lot of disagreement in the community about what those components should be, whether or not, you know, some people even care about different components. And there's plenty of people who, rightfully so, there's not a right and wrong answer to this, are very dug in for 2012, and I can't take that away from them. No one should.
The President Obama campaign saying he does not believe in gay marriage but believes that civil unions with full equality is the right way. Do you think if he outright supported gay marriage, would he have still been elected? And related to that, in some ways, do you think gay issues have lost some of the potency they had in galvanizing the right as before? Has, for example, illegal immigrant become the new gay?
There's plenty of gay immigrants. Look, I want this guy to be as supportive as possible. I don't pretend to think that, you know, any of this is easy. But more importantly, I want those words to come out of his mouth, and I hope someday in the near future that they will come out, that he will publicly support marriage equality for all Americans in a public and verbal way. I don't know if that'll happen, but I hope it will. I hope it will for a lot of politicians. But what he has said is that he does not believe discrimination should be written into any state or federal constitution, and that when a state passes a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, then that is writing discrimination into the Constitution. And it's why he actively supports the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. So I don't, you know, again, I want this guy to be perfect, and I think he's pretty close. But I do believe that his heart is in the right place and that fundamentally he will be there for us almost without fault. Have gay issues lost their luster? No, they haven't. If you look back at the Prop 8 campaign, if you look at what's happening in Maine right now, it's the same arguments. It's, you know, gay people are bad for our children. Gay people are bad for how we're going to teach our children in schools. You know, gay people are going to ruin religious institutions. I mean, it's over and over and over again. And, you know, the right just isn't going to give it up.
Is it getting as much of an audience? Is it resonating as much, I guess?
Yes, I believe it is. That doesn't mean they shouldn't have the courage. It doesn't mean they shouldn't stand up for all Americans. To me, I've gotten to a point in my life where I really don't care if somebody is reelected if they haven't stood up for equality. I really don't care. Why should I? Why should I say that it's okay for you to go back and have another term in office if you haven't done right by me, if you haven't done right by all Americans? So if gay issues are going to be a problem for them, so what? Stand up for us. It's not about your reelection. It's about whether or not you're going to be leaders in this country, whether or not you're going to do the right thing when we give you that power. And if you're not going to do the right thing, then get the hell out of office, and we'll put somebody better in there.
Do you think healthcare is a make-or-break issue for President Obama in that if he cannot get healthcare reform, can he get any of these other laws we are talking about passed?
I said something maybe boldly today that I believe, and I really do believe this, that President Obama and Democrats in Congress will pass a significant health care reform with a public option. I really believe that. I believe that once he got up and gave that speech before Congress and millions of Americans watched it, and when he went out to start campaigning for this legislation and working very hard and getting people to understand what a public option is, sentiment has changed and improved the standing for a public option in health care reform. And I do think that we have a better chance of getting a public option in a health insurance reform bill than not.
Do you think it's possible to replicate the field organization of the Obama candidate without a candidate as unique or inspiring?
Well, I do think inspiration is a pretty critical piece here. But inspiration can be garnered from a lot of different things, not just, a first-time African-American, somebody. Look, his message was very clear and specific. It was about hope and change. And anybody who wanted hope and change knew where to sign up. And, by God, they did it. So I think another candidate, another cause campaign can easily replicate the kind of grassroots enthusiasm if they find the pressure points, and if they provide the inspiration for people to join them.
One of the things President Obama was able to do in his campaign was he moved it a lot away from identity politics, meeting with the Latinos in this room, the Asians in that room. Yet on the marriage issue, it looked like it did matter. The No on Hate campaign was criticized of not reaching out enough to minority communities and things like that. What's your opinion?
There's reason to look back, but there's also reason to look forward. I think it's really important to recognize that any campaign needs to make sure that people have accurate information, or you're putting yourself in jeopardy. It was a problem that the campaign didn't respond as quickly on certain attacks on education, on religion. It was, I don't believe, and this is, I wasn't here, but I've heard it enough, that there wasn't enough work done, enough effort put into communities of color. And if that's the case, it was a fault of the campaign. The bottom line is that if you want to win an election, you have to have a formula. You have to have a sense of how you're going to get to that 50 plus one. And the best operations go in multiple attacks. I think that was one of the successes of the Obama campaign. We didn't have one road to victory. We had a whole bunch of different ways to get there. And we went after all of those ways at once. And I think that any campaign who doesn't do that, you're less able to win. And I think that any community of color, any person, any individual, if you have the ability to have a reasoned conversation with them about what we're looking for, civil marriage rights. We're asking the government to say it's okay. We don't need permission. We're not asking for permission from your church. We're not asking to, insert this in the dialogue for second graders. We're asking to be able to sign that certificate just like straight people do. And if you try and take it away from emotion, religion, education, and take it to a fundamental place, which is we're asking for the government to recognize a marriage, our love that we share with each other, just like they do with other Americans. And I think that you can open that dialogue and get to a lot of places. And I wouldn't suggest that it's just in communities of color. It's with any individual.
I'll try and squeeze in a couple more questions here. You know, you brought up this idea of direct democracy in South Dakota, where you, instead of going to politicians, go straight to the people. That's been a major contributor to California's dysfunctional government. What can citizens of California do to turn back the influence of special interests who have, in effect, hijacked the initiative process?
You know, it's a good question, and I honestly don't feel all that adequate to respond to it. But as I understand it, the process, if it were made a little bit more difficult, you would have greater potential to eliminate some of the potential damaging things, which, you know, damaging things are interpreted in different ways by different people. You know, I know that there's a lot of folks in the progressive community in California, including the Courage Campaign, who are looking at reforms, but I really don't have enough expertise to really address it in a significant way.
Well, we've reached the point where there's time for one last question, so I'll bring it right back home to San Francisco. Since you said you didn't want to be that involved with individual campaigns before, why are you getting involved with the mayoral campaign of Bevin Dufty?
I want to help certain people. And look, I don't profess to believe that my help is any kind of magic. Bevin is somebody who I got to know over the course of the Obama campaign, one of the first gay elected leaders who reached out and said, "Is this guy the real deal?" And through the course of that 2-year period, we got to know each other pretty well. And I want to do whatever I can to help him become mayor, because I think in this day and age, it's a lot about vision, but it's also a lot about detail. And Bevin is the kind of person who has incredible attention to detail. And it's, you know, it's proven in his record and for what so many people say about him. And so I think it's a little bit different. I also think it's about time San Francisco has an openly gay mayor.
Our thanks to Steve Hildebrand, former Deputy Director, Obama's 2008 campaign, advisor to President Obama on LGBT issues, and a consultant to Courage Campaign and Bevin Dufty's mayoral campaign for his comments here today. I'd also like to thank Sandeep Roy of New American Media for moderating this event so well, and thank our audience here as well as those seeing us online and listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.